good way. I've never seen the kind of hope in any political leader's election as I've seen in this. The kind of overwhelming joy is what I mean to say I've never seen anywhere else. But now, as other people have said, it was a day of celebration. Now it's time to get down to work. Barack Obama said it's a day of celebration. He got down to work very early in the Oval Office. He has a lot to face. We have a lot to face. Number one is the economy of the United States of America. We're going to talk about that in overview with our guest, who I'll introduce to you in just a moment. And we do have a great deal to think about with this economy. When his predecessor, George Bush, walked into the White House, he inherited a budget surplus of $128 billion. There was a bright fiscal future. The Congressional Budget Office says that they thought by between 2002-2011 there would be $5.6 trillion in a cumulative budget surplus. But that's not what we're facing now. Now we're facing budget shortfalls, not just shortfalls, but budget deficits, and huge budget deficits in the trillions. And we're facing perhaps even more than that, our debt to foreign countries is in the trillions. And what do we do? And what does Barack Obama face? And how does he address that? And we saw 25 years ago, the communist governments throughout Eastern Europe and Russia fell apart. And it was the end of the communist economic system, at least as we know it at that moment. And now people are saying maybe this is the end of the capitalist system. What replaces it? There was a quote from Supreme Court Justice Louis Brandeis, 80 years ago, who was one of the great justices ever of the United States Supreme Court. His quote was, "We can have democracy in this country, or we can have great wealth concentrated in the hands of a few, but we can't have both," he said. And the top 1% of Americans created under Bush over 23% of the American wealth. They concentrate into their hands. 50% of all Americans share 12.5% of that wealth. Something is askew. People are losing their homes. What do we do about it, and what is really going on? We have joining me in the studio is an old colleague of mine. He's not so old, but he's been a colleague of mine for some time, a leading economic thinker. He's chairman and CEO of the Sage Policy Group, and has been commenting on economics in our country and the world for a long, long time, Anirban Basu. And Anirban Basu, welcome. Good to have you with us.
Thank you so much, Mark.
And folks, welcome. 410-319-8888. Your thoughts on the economy. It's the first thing our president has to tackle. How should he tackle it? Is it being done right? 410-319-8888. Write to us here at steinershow@gmail.com. This is huge, what we face here in America. So, day one, I mean, the question is, just explain some things to me and to our listeners for a moment. The deficit that we're in right now. President Bush, we lost over $1 trillion in taxes under President Bush because he had tax cuts. Everybody wants tax cuts, don't want to pay taxes. But then we expanded the Iraq War, with the military budget, with promising prescription aid under Medicare Part B. The deficit just ballooned because of Bush. So,
right, the deficit balloons because of Bush and Congress. But
Bush and Congress. Let's leave Congress out of this.
Yeah,
as well.
That's absolutely right. And it's true that as Bush is inaugurated 8 years ago, almost to the day, he is inheriting surpluses. The outlook for America still at that time from a fiscal perspective is actually not that great, because even with those accumulated surpluses, America was still facing trillions of dollars of unfunded Social Security and Medicare liabilities well into the future. But certainly 8 years ago, things looked rosier than they do now. The accumulated federal budget deficit is over $10 trillion. The Congressional Budget Office had predicted a few months ago that for fiscal year 2009, and the federal fiscal year begins in October of every year, that for fiscal year 2009, the deficit would be around $450 billion. The latest forecast is $1.2 trillion. But that includes the Social Security surplus. So if you strip that out, it's actually $1.4 trillion or close to that. And the president-elect, when he was president-elect, President Obama, suggested that we would be facing trillion-dollar deficits for years to come. Mm-hmm. That's roughly 7% of gross domestic product. That's a big number. And so we have a prevailing national debt. We have trillions of dollars in unfunded future Medicare and Social Security liabilities, not to mention Homeland Security, defense, education, so on and so forth. And of course, we have more fiscal deficits to come. So the question becomes, how do we pay it all back? when will we pay it all back?
And how do we do that? When our national debt, when Bush took office, was $5.7 trillion, the debt that we owed in this country. It's now up to at least $10.6 to $11 trillion. Explain to us what that means. Explain to us, and to me as well, the question of debt and who we owe it to and why do we owe it to Taiwan and China and the Emirates and the oil producing companies. How do we owe them the money? What do they do for us to owe them trillions of dollars?
Right. Well, some of the debt we owe to them, some of the debt we owe to ourselves. But the way, you know, basically deficits are nothing more than government spending more now than they have resources now. And so they have to borrow against the future. They finance that borrowing by issuing bonds, government bonds, and people buy those bonds. And that they're really becoming, they're a lender to government. That's, they're nothing more than a lender. You and I, Mark, are lenders to our government. And, you know, as long as they're able to continue to float debt, it's not really a crisis. The deficit gets bigger and bigger and bigger, but government is able to operate from day to day to day. And that's the situation we're in right now. What causes us dread, deep dread, is the notion that at some point, government can't keep doing this and that we have to pay this back at some point. So that's what it means. And the Chinese and the Indians and the Russians and the South Koreans and many, many others have bought this debt. So they hold it. And, you know, at some level, that's not a bad thing because government needs the money, our government. But at another level, it says, well, we're pretty dependent upon the foreigner to finance our government. And that gives the foreigner a certain amount of leverage, political and otherwise, strategic leverage, over our government, which is one of the reasons, if you notice our trade negotiations in past years with the Chinese, as an example, we've had to walk on eggshells with them. Now, we're their customer. I mean, they produce, we buy. And the customer's always right. But the customer apparently is not always right when the customer owes the vendor a lot of money. And that's the situation in which we find ourselves.
So there was a time in America, from my reading of economic history, that our debt was financed by our savings. Under Roosevelt, World War II, our debt was financed under because people saved. That's so the Americans financed our own debt. The government was indebted to us, the people.
Correct. Right.
But that's not the case anymore.
No, because we used to buy our own bonds. But now the debt's so large that the American population, the American household, which, by the way, doesn't save enough to begin with. But even if they did save more.
Because we can't save.
Well, we don't. We can. Our history as a people is that we can save. I mean, we, from our nation's infancy, Mark, were great savers, fabulous savers, financing projects like the Erie Canal, which I believe begins construction in 1816. The nation is very young, a tiny economy. The Erie Canal project is massive. The B&O Railroad project is massive. And yet, and this is you know, close to the middle part of the 19th century, the B&O. But in any case, the point is we were able to save and engage in what other countries and what we called at the time internal improvements. The Americans were able to amass massive amounts of capital to invest in our infrastructure. It gave us a competitive advantage so that almost instantaneously by the 19th century, we were an industrial power. We were a rival to the European powers even as soon as the 19th century. Despite our civil war and all the other things going on in our 19th century, we emerged that way to the point that by World War I, we were probably the world's greatest power. And certainly in World War II, that was the case. So our nation's history has been one of being able to save and invest and having a government that's quite responsible with its finances, continues to invest in infrastructure, continues to connect markets and people together. Look at us, our government today, and look at our infrastructure today. Our government is facing massive amounts of debt, and yet, despite that, we have massive infrastructure shortfalls, whether it's in our nation's air traffic control system or the power grid, you name it. How did it come to this? It came to this because we Americans, I think, largely have not kept our eye on the ball. We've borrowed not for particularly good purposes. We've spent for not particularly good purposes, short-term in orientation. And so here we are.
Folks, I'm with Anirban Basu, Chairman and CEO of the Sage Policy Group, one of the people I think around who can really popularize the understanding of economics and what we're facing. We worked together for many years on radio. He joins us here now on the Mark Steiner Show. I want you to join us at 410-319-8888. It is your economy. It is your dollar. President Barack Obama now has to figure out how to save this economy. Do we do it by bailing out banks? We'll talk about that. Are there other ways? Can we do it by investing in infrastructure and this new green economy? Is it viable? Can we do that? And we spend so much money on the war, on military in general. Does that have to be pared down? Medicare, Social Security, how do we pay for retirement? Where do we go? And what are the options that we face? We have a great deal of hope now, but what's the reality that is fueled by this hope? 410-319-8888. Give us your thoughts or write to us here at steinershow@gmail.com. I mean, I was reading this, Paul Stiglitz, an economist. He wrote an article, and it was in the Harper's, and he said the national debt is now more than 70%, as we were talking about earlier, of our gross domestic product. 70%. The highest portion, he says, in a half a century. And the percentage of that public debt owed to foreign nationals is up to 46% of that debt. That's huge.
Yeah, there's two things here. There's the national debt, which is sort of our accumulated debt over time. And then there's our annual fiscal budget deficit. What deficit are we generating in any particular 12-month period? That is 7%. The national debt is 70%. Both numbers are scary.
And what we realize is that when the federal government took over the failing residential mortgage giants of Fannie Mae and Freddie Mac, which used to be government run, and then they got all botched up for 30 years and became an agency that just passed money through rather than regulating money. We also had to assume that $5.4 trillion debt from Fannie Mae and Freddie Mac. So if you look at any way of managing books, you have to add that on to the $10 trillion that we already have.
Mark, that's exactly right. There are liabilities out there. I mean, for instance, as an example, the Troubled Assets Relief Program, the $700 billion, the presumption is that that money that's going to the banks, that has been going to the banks in very large amounts, in some cases $25 billion at a time, will be paid back to us. Now, what if it's not?
What if it's not?
Then, obviously, that accretes to the deficit.
Well, let me talk about the banks for a minute. Then we're going to open the phones, and Christine and Helene, who are the first callers, join us here at 410-319-8888. I want you in on this conversation with Anirban Basu and myself here about the economic crisis and about what Barack Obama can, must, and should do, and how does he address the issues we're facing. Some leading economists, Paul Krugman and others, are saying that one of the places that President Obama may be missing the boat, as well as some members of Congress, is by doing the bailout of banks the way they're doing it now. That we're throwing money into a bottomless pit. That if these banks are so undervalued, we don't even know what the undervalue means, and don't know the amount of that, of the undervaluation of those banks at the moment, how they're failing, that what we should be doing is what we did during the savings and loan crisis, which is to literally take over the banks, take over their assets and failing debts, shore them up, and then resell them so they can become solvent again, rather than just pouring money down a hole. I mean, Wells Fargo, you give money to Wells Fargo, and they're saying, we're going to take this money and use it the way we want to. We're buying other banks. We're giving hundreds of millions of dollars to our executives. So there's no control here. So are President Obama and some of the leading financial thinkers in government at this moment missing the boat on how they're doing this?
The first question is, how is the TARP money, that $700 billion, the first half of which has been spent roughly, how was that used? And basically, the way that this has been formulated is that the government would buy toxic assets off the balance sheets of these banks and replace those toxic assets with cash, thereby reinstilling health into the banking system. But almost immediately, they scrapped the program. They said, you know what? That takes too much time. These reverse auctions are complicated. They just sound complicated. We're just going to stroke checks to the banks. So here you go, Citigroup, $25 billion.
Right.
Within months, Citigroup says, thank you very much, 53,000 layoffs. PNC Bank gets $7.3 billion.
Right.
Within hours, they say, thank you very much, we're going to buy National City for $5.8. So this is what's been happening. Now, one could say that what there should be is a quid pro quo. Banks, if we give you the money to shore up your balance sheet, you need to make loans. Here's the problem with that, Mark. The problem with that is, my goodness, this is a risky lending environment. We got into this problem by making too many loans, making too many bad loans, too many faulty loans. And as a result, government has to sort of, again, walk on eggshells, which is, should I ask the banks to make loans in an environment where I know the lending environment has become very risky? Why? Because the economy is in free fall. Do I want to be lending to businesses, construction firms, and others, even households, in an environment that's getting weaker? Will I not create an even greater banking crisis? That's the problem for government. There's no good solution to this, but I agree with you 100%. The way that the monies have been spent has almost had no positive impact on our economy. How the second part of the money will be spent, and obviously Tim Geithner, once the Senate approves him, will you know, we'll see. The new Secretary of the Treasury, right? He's got this tax issue and so on. But in any case, once he, presumably he's approved and he becomes Secretary of the Treasury, what will he do differently? I think we don't know yet. It's speculative how he will handle TARP 2 differently than TARP 1.
Some people argue that where we should be putting our money is not in banks at the moment, but unless we're going to do what I suggested earlier with savings, like they did with the savings and loan crisis, taking over the banks and then reselling them and shoring them up that way. But by some people are arguing you should massively fuel the economy by building infrastructure. Others say that's a waste. By building bridges, schools, the green economy, redoing the electric grid, and investing in the social sector, the public sector, to build that, the private sector can manage it and run it, but investing in the public sector, that way creating jobs and creating an environment where people might start saving again and using their money again, and that's where the trillions of dollars should go, the hundreds of billions of dollars should go, not into banks.
Oh, I don't disagree at all. I think that that's exactly right. That we know we have a national infrastructure deficit, whether it's with respect to our air traffic control system, our electrical grid, rail, commuter rail on the East and West Coast. I mean, if you map economic activity in the world and look for concentrations of economic activity, you'll find very few areas of the world that have more dense economic activity than the East and West Coast of the United States. And you would look at the world and say, okay, if there's going to be a couple of parts of the world where I know there's going to be high-speed rail available to the population, it's the East and West Coast of the United States. What do we have, Mark? We have Amtrak. And so that just tells you we have infrastructure deficits. Look at the quality of our public schools in Baltimore City in terms of physically. You know, the boilers don't work.
Right.
The boilers, the chillers, the windows, so on and so forth. Many of our schools don't have playgrounds, so on and so forth. You can address that kind of infrastructure deficit with this money and still put people to work. I will say another thing, just one final thing about that. Disproportionately, you'd put men to work because 88% of all construction workers are men. Now, that doesn't sound fair at some level, but the unemployment rate for men in our country is 1.3% higher than it is for women. And so putting men back to work is not such a bad idea.
But if you put money into social services and put money into taking care of troubled children and put money into schools, that puts women to work as well.
Oh, it's good for everyone. I mean, that's exactly right. It's absolutely good for everyone. You know, my only point is that men have just, lot of people don't focus on this, men have taken it on the chin economically. You know, everyone knows about the manufacturing job losses year after year after year. 70% of all manufacturing workers are men.
Right.
So whenever you hear about manufacturing layoffs of that group, it's likely that 70% of them will be men, 30% will be
women.
And
when we talk about stabilizing families, especially in inner city neighborhoods and in poor communities, stabilization means fathers and mothers, but especially fathers, can bring home a paycheck, take care of children, and be in the home and not somewhere else.
Be a male role model. I mean, the community is crying out for male role models.
But then here, one more question then. Christine, Eric, Halim, and Russ, to your calls, but I want to get you in here. There's many other things to raise during the course of our hour with Anubhav Basu about our economy. But many people argue that putting money into the infrastructure does nothing positive for the long-term economy, that doesn't fuel economic growth.
That's just nonsense. I mean, if we can move people, you know, get people to work more in a more timely fashion so they can be more productive, if we have schools that can accommodate the best technologies, if we have hospitals that can help deliver the best health care, if we have an air traffic control system that's more efficient, reduces delays, and allows us to fly more safely, how does that not generate a long-term benefit? Clearly, the benefit is long-term. And indeed, you know, in many ways, our infrastructure disallows the Americans from being as productive as we ought to be relative to other people in the world. Yes, it's true. We are the most productive people in the world. But imagine if we weren't stuck in traffic 30 minutes every day, how much more productive we would be. So I disagree with that 100%. That's exactly the reason to invest in infrastructure. It helps the economy in the short term and the long term.
Anubhav Basu is one of our leading economic, procrastinators and one of our economic thinkers, chairman and CEO of the Sage Policy Group. He is a commentator is the word I'm looking for, and I'm struggling here as a radio talk show trying to figure out the right word. An economic commentator on our times has been doing it for many, many years and is usually right on the money and breaks this down for all of us to understand it. And you can join us here with your thoughts on the future of our economy, what Barack Obama should be doing. 410-319-8888 is the number here. Write to us at steinershow@gmail.com. And let's go to the phones, and we'll raise some other issues in a few minutes. But let me go to Christine in Baltimore. You're on the air.
Hi,
Christine.
Good evening, everyone. I'm a first-time caller and actually a first-time listener.
Oh, pleasure to have you.
Yes, and I've been sitting here listening and shaking my head and nodding in agreement with everything that has been discussed. I have been a supporter of President Obama, and I'm very encouraged by his vision and his thinking. And I think, I feel that what he has planned falls in line with what has been discussed. I believe that if we do look at some of these, which he classified as infrastructure issues, addressing some of a lot of the social needs that we have, it definitely puts people back to work. Thinking in the long term, it does help bring families together. I'm married with two children, and you know, my husband and I do okay, but we can be doing much, you know, much better. One thing I wanted to comment on was the banks. Now, I'm, you know, the whole concept doesn't really, you know, it confuses me a lot, but I personally felt that the banks should have just been, they should have been allowed to just crash, because my position is that human nature dictates if you give these banks too much money, it doesn't teach them to be responsible. It just perpetuates the vicious cycle that we've gotten ourselves into. However, going forward, because of President Obama's position on wanting to reposition ourselves to the world, and his position on being diplomatic and his overall poise, mm-hmm. I do believe in the future our relationships with other countries will improve, so that these situations that we're in now, where other people have, you know, are holding our debts, would be easier to deal with over the course of time. So I'm very encouraged. I just wanted to share that. Thank you.
Christine, thanks so much. Let me ask you, I appreciate being part of the show, and I'm glad you're tuning in, and tune in some more. Anibon, before we go to the next caller, talk a bit about this debt service to other countries again, since Christine finished with that. How do we get out of that? How do we address that? How does America get to the point where the majority of our debt is controlled by us, as opposed to, or is that impossible in the international climate today because of the closeness of national economies?
No, it's not clear that it's really that desirable. I mean, when foreigners are buying American debt, it's just, you know, in some ways it's an expression of confidence. But you can have too much of a good thing, and I think that's where we are now. Too much foreign ownership of our debt, which gives them too much leverage, strategic and other forms of leverage. And so the way to do this is very simple, Mark, which is for our government to return to a balanced budget so that they don't have to issue so much debt. So there's not so much debt to buy by foreigners or even Americans.
Well, how do you get to a balanced budget if we're talking about filling the economy, which is going to create a larger deficit, building infrastructure, creating a larger deficit, taking care of schools, reforming health care? So this is going to create greater deficit. So how do you get to a balanced budget?
Oh, well, no. Look, there's short term and there's long term. I mean, when we're talking about balanced budget, we're talking about the long term. We're talking about many years from now. And it's very likely that President Obama could put us on the right track, but he, during his two terms, and let's presume he'll have two terms, will never see a fiscal surplus, even if he does everything correctly. Such is the nature of our deficit. So massive is it. But at least he can put us on a better trajectory than we're headed on now, because the trajectory we're headed on now is simply larger and larger deficits with each and every passing fiscal year. But in the short term, as he has pointed out, we are facing larger deficits, and there's no way around that. Now, here's the thing. Even if there's no stimulus package, the deficit probably gets bigger. Why is that? Because the economy is in free fall. We lost 584,000 jobs as a nation in November, 524,000 jobs in December, and it's going to get worse.
7.2% unemployment now, and it may be higher at this moment.
Well, I mean, that's exactly right. And the unemployment rate has been rising. You know, last month it rose half a percentage point in one month. My guess is that by the end of the year, you're looking at not quite a 9% unemployment rate, and it won't even peak until 2010. So, and that's with the stimulus package. So, but the deficit is going to get bigger, because when you have an economy that's so weak, you have less deal flow, fewer transactions in the economy, less income growth, and so you have less tax collections. And so this is part of the logic of the stimulus plan. Hey, let's fix the economy now so that at some point, sooner rather than later, it can start generating tax revenue growth again. And that's part of Obama's mission, is to try to turn this around in the next couple of years so that the economy, the private sector, can begin to send checks to government as opposed to government sending checks to the private sector.
410-319-8888. And Halim, you're on the air.
Yes, how y'all doing?
Well.
Well, I'm looking at the idea of trickle-down economics, which means to me that the vast majority of the wealth is at the top, and it just trickles down to the middle and lower economic class, which means that the wages remain small while prices increase. And in time, you have the collapse of the economy. And, you know, therefore, I don't think that the solution is at the top as it is at the bottom. And that is the way that we teach our children, go to school, get a job, you know, and retire. We have to teach our children economics, how to create opportunity for themselves, how, you know, have multiple streams of income. Don't just rely on one source of income and take matters into your own hand, and don't just depend on an employee. I mean, I'm sorry, an employer to provide opportunity for you, but to look and create opportunity for yourself.
Which can be hard, I mean, to create kind of a thing on your own in this economic period.
Well, you know, my nephew, he says the same thing, and I took him to Walmart and I bought him a waxer and showed him how he could start his own detail business. Now he's making money. You know, you got to think outside the box. There's ways to make money. He thought because he had a record that he couldn't get a job, but now he has a job and he don't have to go back to crime.
You're a good uncle.
Yeah.
Yes. Well, again, look, I believe in American capitalism and American entrepreneurship. We'll be back. You know, the Americans, we always come back, whether it's from the Great Depression or the early 1980s or whatever it happens to be, we'll be back. The question is, how do we get there and what kind of people will we be? I mean, a lot of people like to demonize the Bush administration, the second Bush administration, and some of that is undoubtedly deserved. But the fact is that the growing inequality of incomes in America was occurring well before George Bush the second became president. That it was happening since the late 1970s when manufacturing employment really begins to decline in this country. And manufacturing was a gateway for many people in the American middle class to be in the middle class even without elevated educational attainment. Since that time, we've seen the number of manufacturing jobs decline, particularly in the Baltimore area, of course, but throughout much of the country, with the exception of parts of the American South. Moreover, we also have the advent of globalization. And what that does, Mark, is for people who have globally relevant skills, whether in financial management or in international trade, production, innovation, the returns to their skills have grown by leaps and bounds. It's one of the reasons that the rich have become so much richer. But for the working class, you know, the American who has skills similar to somebody in the Indian or Chinese middle classes or the Mexican middle class, the problem is this. If I'm having to compete now as a middle-class American with a middle-class Mexican or a middle-class Chinese person, their cost of living is much less than mine. They can underbid me. They can underbid me for jobs. They win factories away from me. And so my living standards stagnate while theirs improves. And the only way out of that, and the caller was right on the mark, it's education. Our middle class has to be smarter than any other middle class in the world. Otherwise, they cannot sustain the highest quality of life.
We have to take a short break. And when we come back from this break, first I want to remind you the Mark Steiner Show is brought to you by MeQ, Baltimore's credit union, offering a full range of financial services. MeQ was formed in 1936 to help people during the Great Depression. Over 70 years later, they're still coming to help during difficult times. For more information, go to mecu.com. And when we come back, Russ and Gary, Maria, Eric, callers interested in joining in, we'll get to your calls, and I will approach the subject whether the problem is capitalism itself. Is it eating itself alive? Is capitalism the problem? We'll let Anirban respond to that when we return, as we have a conversation with Anirban Basu about our economy, Obama, and the future. Stay with us. Welcome back. I'm Mark Steiner. I want to remind you that the Mark Steiner Show is made possible by the Maryland State Mortgage Late Don't Wait program. For more information and personal counseling, the number is 1-877-462-7555. My guest this hour is Anirban Basu. Anirban Basu is one of our great economic commentators. Been doing this on radio for a long time and is chairman and CEO of the Sage Policy Group. joins us for a little discussion on, a very important discussion on the economic future of America, President Barack Obama and his policies, and what the future may bring. And Anirban, one quick question, right back to the phones. There are a lot of people arguing that one of the things that, that Barack Obama has suggested is a tax cut for businesses and individuals. Not the tax cut. Some people think the tax cut he offered during the election was a mistake for people making $200,000 or less a year. Though most people making that money like that idea, because that's most of America making less than that, much less than that, I would add. But that what he's doing here is doing a pay on to the conservative forces in Congress, the Republicans, who want to see tax cuts. And that's the exact wrong thing to do at this moment to stabilize the economy, because the tax cuts we, that President George Bush put in place was an exacerbator and root of the problem we have now.
Yeah, I mean, look, if you're trying to stimulate the economy in the short term, it's not that tax cuts would hurt that, right? If people have more money, you know, disposable income, then presumably that helps the economy. That's not the issue. The issue is, what else could you do with that money? And could you more directly impact the economy if you didn't use that money for tax cuts and use it for, as we've said earlier, infrastructure or to help people refinance into new mortgage products or whatever it happens to be? And my sense is that, you know, and economists are all over the board on this one, but my sense is that there are, in fact, more direct ways to stimulate the economy than more tax cuts. That's really not the problem, high tax rates. The problem right now is just a lack of confidence. People have a lack of confidence in their future, in their bank, in their investment advisor, in their job security, so on and so forth. And so the response is to pull into their shell.
Well, what would happen if you put less money into the banks, unless you did, as I suggested earlier, and you haven't really said it's a bad or a good idea yet, the idea of doing what we did with the savings and loans, which is taking over the banks, restructuring their debt, and then reselling the banks and controlling that, and then setting up regulatory things so they can control the financial industry in this country so they can't bottom us out anymore like they've done this time. And instead of putting all the money there, but to put it into infrastructure, to put people to work, rebuild the nation itself, that giving the people themselves more confidence in their economy because they have paychecks in their pocket.
Again, you know, look, that's a little different from the issue of tax cuts or no tax cuts.
No, it is.
But, you know,
now we're talking about your question of confidence is what I was.
Well, I mean, what would restore confidence? What restores confidence is, you know, it could be just Barack Obama himself. You know, my hope is that he'll be able to move forward with an economic plan of his own making and that Congress is not going to water it down. And my sense is that when, you know, we started hearing more and more in the last couple of weeks about tax cuts being a big part of this, my feeling was, this does not sound like Mr. Obama. This sounds like Mr. Obama, the man who has to deal with Congress as the 44th president of the United States and knows that he has to negotiate. And, you know, he's the type of person who negotiates. He's willing to, you know, bridge divides and so on and so forth. That said, you know, again, I think you could stimulate the economy much more directly, you know, by infrastructure spending and just putting people to work and stopping this rise, this monthly increase in the unemployment rate, because that's what really freaks people out. I mean, when people judge the state of the economy, one measure stands out more than any other in terms of how they judge the economy's performance. That's the unemployment rate. And when it's rising, that's the economy's bad. And when it's falling, the economy is better. Now, there are other measures too, inflation, the performance of the Dow Jones Industrial Average. So I'm not saying it's just unemployment, but unemployment has a disproportionate impact on the American psyche. And when other people are losing jobs, you are working right now, Mark.
Thank
but
God.
When you watch other people losing their jobs,
No.
It makes all of us nervous.
Our little company here that does our show and puts it here on WEAA, we have four people employed. I'm constantly worried that how do we keep everybody employed? You know, this is a very tough economy. This is not easy. And, you know, you feel loyalty to the people you work with. And another day, 410-319-8888. Dr. Anirban Basu is our guest. We're talking about the economy. He is chairman and CEO of the Sage Policy Group that consults on economic matters with governments and private industry. 410-319-8888 is the number here. Let's go to Russ in East Baltimore. You're on the air.
Greetings, Mark.
Hi, Russ. Yes. Welcome.
Mark, let me say in the beginning here that the gentleman was talking about trickle-down. Well, Main Street may have been trickled, been playing trickle down, but Wall Street was playing leaving nothing on the table. I think when I hear us talking about all these piecemeal things about the economy, the housing business, the bank business, and all that, that we're missing a larger point, because I see the meltdown that took Lehman and the rest of them away as being a part of the credit default swap situation. And if you look at the basis of that, the American the commercial paper market in America is roughly $5 trillion. Well, the credit default swap issue takes us to a place where they bet about $50 trillion on those $5 trillion worth of assets. And if you look at world GDP, it's $57 trillion, and you're looking at a problem where maybe, just maybe, there's nothing the government can do. Maybe we're spending a lot of borrowing. And I mean, I just can't get my mind around the idea that the way out of debt is more debt. Or that if you're making $500 a week and your bills are $700 a week, that you need to go get a job making $400 with these tax businesses. So maybe we need to start looking at the larger issue of what's really there and what's really causing the problem, so that we can kind of look down the road and say maybe the government should be keeping this powder dry for the other end of this mess that we've created.
That's a very interesting point, Russ.
Yes, I mean, there are economists who would suggest that really government should just throw up its hands and the Federal Reserve should just throw up its hands and there's not much we can do about this. But look, my sense is, at least, you know, as a, from a practical perspective, this president, this new president is going to do everything he can do to bring this economy back to life. And it's interesting because the caller talks about broader issues, bigger issues, and then talks about sort of micro issues like credit default swaps and so on and so forth. I mean, I think the bigger issue here, Mark, is American behavior. And how do we behave economically? And it's not just about the corruption on Wall Street, and it's not just about Bernie Madoff. It's every single household in America. And on the average household in America, are they responsible in their spending and savings behavior? And my sense is, Mark, we have not been responsible. We have become a society that focuses on consumerism more than any other thing. We see ourselves as a nation of consumers. We value ourselves in terms of the quality of our consumption. What car do we drive? Where do we live? Is it an SUV? How much horsepower? Are our countertops granite or Corian and so on and so forth? We stop thinking about sort of our value as a producer, as a person in the community, as a family member. And I think, you know, we are, you know, sort of suffering the pains of that.
Before we go to Gary, Maria, and Eric and Brian, let me ask this question and get down to something what Russ was alluding to. And I'm going to quote somebody who doesn't get quoted very much or think about it, not really quote him, but use his ideas. And that's Karl Marx. Karl Marx, it has nothing to do with the communist states that failed. He had a theory about how capitalism works. And one of the things Karl Marx would say if he was here right now is that capitalism has a tendency towards overproduction and market crisis. That's the nature of how the capitalist beast works. And hyper-financial accumulation. And for that to work, you have to have people so the wealthiest in the society accumulate all this money and push the economy to a point where they can make their billions and they don't give a damn about the rest of the world and the rest of the world suffers for it. And on the other hand, it relies on consumption, consumer consumption. And since they couldn't get consumer consumption, they being the big capitalists, we create the credit world. And the credit world gives you this little plastic card that started back in the 70s. It makes you think you have the money you don't have. And you consume, consume, consume with that credit card so that our debt is not just federal debt, but it's personal debt in this country, which is destroying us and eating us alive. And that we maybe capitalism itself has to think about a restructuring of how we manage and run capitalism so it is not just free market madness doing whatever people who are super wealthy want to do. At the same time, you have a system that builds an economy not built on consumerism.
Look, Mark, I mean, I think that's exactly – I mean, much of that is right, which is – people have to be responsible. A free market is free. People are free to make decisions, what to buy, to a certain extent, how much to buy. But if those decisions are systematically irresponsible, people are going to suffer bad outcomes. Now, many of your listeners, by the way, they don't have these issues. They earn more than they spend. They save money each and every year, each and every passing month. They're saving for their kids' colleges. They're making their monthly mortgage payments. In fact, that's most people, remarkably. So responsible capitalism still generates tremendously good outcomes. Again, I think there's a cultural phenomenon here that we Americans have just become, you know, sort of all about instant gratification constantly. We need the newest iPod right now, so on and so forth. And forget about whether or not we can make our mortgage. It's purple. So that's the problem here. And so the question becomes, it's a cultural one. How do we get back to our roots as a country? Not to say that Not to say that we were perfect back in the day. We clearly were not. But one of the things that American households were famous for was not spending all of their money, saving, being scared, saving for a rainy day. Remember, in our early history, there was no government safety net. There was no unemployment insurance program. You lived by your own means, which forced you, of course, to be very responsible in your behavior.
People also died early. There was no health care. People were not getting educated. I mean, all that was true, too.
True. That's true, too. But the point is, remarkably, people didn't necessarily lose their homes at the same pace that they're losing their homes now. I mean, it used to be the case, that it's sort of an American tradition for homeowners, that you would have your mortgage burning ceremony at the age of 55 because you bought your home, you paid it off, and now there you were. And now you owned an asset that you could pass on to the next generation. Think about how many Baltimoreans, and you're familiar with Baltimore, think about how many Baltimoreans live in homes that their parents or grandparents bought.
My father was one of those. He did that. Right.
Okay, there you have it. Now we have a generation of people who not only are not able to pass that home along to their next generation, they're not even able to stay in it for the rest of their lives. So our behavior has changed. It's not that our economy has gotten smaller over time. It has in the last year, but not over time. And yet we're less able to keep up. Why? Because we just spend.
It's not all the consumer. It's also the fact that there's no regulations on the corporate world and the financial world that allow them to run amok with the finances of this country and sink us like a stone.
Undoubtedly, I agree with that 100%. And here's the thing. You know, in the 1990s, it was quite popular to talk about sort of the end of history because communism had faltered and the capitalist model had emerged supreme, and that was where the world was headed. Free market capitalism, sort of what Adam Smith was writing about in the 1770s, deregulated, unrestricted, lower taxes, so on and so forth. This episode, Mark, has ended very badly. The capitalist class got everything it wanted. It got deregulation, whether it was energy or financial services or railroads or airlines, you name it. It got lower taxes, capital gains, dividend, highest marginal income taxes. The private sector got everything it wanted. And what has been happening lately? The private sector now is saying, oh my goodness, government, bail us out of our own mess. So my guess is we're going to be rolling some of this back and that we will not be in the sort of this free market, laissez-faire environment that we've been in. And the question for Barack Obama and for the new Congress is, how do we restructure capitalism? What regulations? How are they implemented? Who implements them? How many agencies? What are the consequences for not abiding by the regulations? This has to be completely rethought. And it will be. That's one of the reasons there's so much uncertainty in the private sector right now. They don't know what the new regulatory regime looks like. And which is why much of the private sector, including the banks, remains disengaged from the main street economy.
Anirban Basu is our guest. We're talking about our American economy. Let's turn this over to you at 410-319-8888. And Gary in Baltimore, you're on the air.
Thank you for having me.
Go ahead.
Both of you. I just wanted to speak on kind of like extent what you talked about. Mark, can you guys hear me?
Not too well, but...
Okay, can you hear me better now?
Go ahead.
Okay. Well, first of all, I hear your guest talking about the free market. And if he would read a little bit of People's History of the United States by Howard
Zinn,
he would know that free markets are not so great. And what you find more and more people talking about are fair markets. Fair markets for the world's population, not just for America, not just for Western society. And, you know, on this very station some years ago, I heard one of your financial guests described the word mortgage. When you take the word M-O-R-T, that means death. And you take the word mortgage, it means pay until you die. And what we have now, we have socialists for the rich, and we have capitalists for the workers. I encourage your listeners to check out the documentary Zeitgeist Addendum. It'll give them a very good idea of just how ludicrous this entire system of predatory capitalism is. 1 billion people, and that invocation by the reverend or pastor at Sunday's mall spectacle, they cut out on HBO, but I read this morning online, and he talked about the 1 billion people on this planet who live on $1 a day or less.
Right, right.
The world's population lives on $2.50 a day.
Okay.
And we must start to think about them because, as the Dalai Lama said, it is in our own self-interest to be compassionate and empathetic, because then we wouldn't have to spend all this money on all this military garbage, and the human capital would come to fruition. And I'll just leave it out there. I wanted to throw that out there. too often we're isolationists in our thinking. So I'll let the other callers chime in, and thank you for your time. Goodbye.
Gary, thank you so much. I think you hit some very important points. I mean, I think that we need to think about a different world, a more compassionate world. I mean, and that, I mean, for you as an economist, Anirban, I mean, you're not just an economist. You're also a deep student of Buddhism. I know that, and I have been for many years. And what Gary's talking about is we have to figure out a different way to build a different way of living, a different economy that is not just about profit, but it has to have more of the word cooperation and taking care of everybody to make this place work.
Right. Buddhism, the middle way, right? The middle path. Isn't that right? So it's moderation. I mean, remember, where do people live on $1 a day or less? It's not in places that have the free market. It's in places, in fact, where the market is very restricted. Who is more prosperous, the North Koreans or the South Koreans? Who embraces the free market? Who is home to Hyundai and LG and all these companies?
Two-thirds of India, which is a democratic capitalist nation, live in the most abject poverty in the world.
How long has India been capitalistic? I mean, for many, many years post-1947, the year of its independence, India was a socialist nation, really closer to the Soviet Union than it was to the United States. It's only been since the 1990s that Indians have significantly liberalized their markets. And now, all of a sudden, what are we talking about? The technology sectors in Bangalore, Hyderabad, Mumbai, so on and so forth. A middle class of several hundred million in size. But that was after the freeing of markets
but
in India.
Given the limitation on resources in the world, I mean, you can't have Wall Street and Hyderabad be the watchword of the day if we're going to feed the rest of the world.
Ah, that's another issue. I mean, the other issue is sustainability. So, I mean, but what is the option, Mark? Is the option we have to keep a certain proportion of the world so poor that it doesn't consume the world's scarce resources?
We have stimulated this conversation. Let's get back to the phones and let people join us here. 410-319-8888. Maria, you've been holding on a long time. You're on the air. Maria, are you there?
Can you hear me?
Yeah, Maria, are you there? Go ahead.
Yeah, I am. Okay. It's Maria Allwein. You know, I absolutely agree with Gary. Everything he said is absolutely correct, but the point I want to make is that the GAO came out with a report last year. Nobody talks about corporate income taxes and the amount they don't pay being a huge problem. And the GAO found that most corporations don't pay any income tax. Even though the rate may be theoretically high, the actual money that they pay is next to nothing. And this capitalist system that we have encourages that. That's one thing that President Obama needs to fix, and it's a sea change. The other thing that I think needs to happen is all financial transactions need to be taxed. And the tax is small, 0.1%. It's called a Tobin tax. I'm sure Mr. Basu is aware of it. And it would discourage the kind of reckless speculation that has occurred in these last few years. It would discourage that, and it would also contribute billions of dollars to the Treasury. So those are just a couple of many things, many sea changes that need to occur in order for there to be an economically just system for everybody.
Maria, always, I'm sorry.
Thank you. That's it.
Thank you so much.
Well, okay. I mean, she brings up a couple of incredibly good points. And I'll say one thing, you know, she's absolutely right, for instance, about the corporate tax and the tax code generally, which is it's too complicated. It's too full of holes. It's like cheddar cheese. And so, yes, there is this corporate tax rate, but because there are so many exemptions and deductions and so on and so forth, it's not clear what corporations ought to pay. It's too complicated. It's too complicated for the auditors to figure out. There's not enough auditing power in the country, certainly not at the IRS, to deal with all of these issues. And so corporations go year after year without paying a sufficient level of taxes. One of the things I would hope that this president would do is simplify the tax code, not just for corporations, but for all of us. And that would be very valuable. But the reason that the tax code is so complicated is it's very simple, politics. And everyone's looking for their own exemption, their own deduction, so on and so forth. And over time, you have this massive tax code that hardly anyone can understand, even the incoming Secretary of the Treasury.
Nobody knows how to understand this right now or how this even works.
That's exactly right.
Which is why President Obama has said he's going to step back before he makes any major decisions to study and see what they're going to do, not study for too long. 410-319-8888. Eric, you've been holding on a while. You're on the air.
Good contributions by everybody, by the callers and the panel this evening.
Thank you.
Yeah, I just like to say, as a parent and a stakeholder, both of you mentioned the free market system and how it relates to the school system. Well, in Baltimore City, we now have a free market system, which is called Fair Student Funding. And under Fair Student Funding, this model, each student's funding allocation follows the student to whatever school he or she attends. Wow. Now, the base funding amount per pupil is $3,940. What I'd like to have a conversation with Arnir Bonbasu and Mark joining in is I have some questions about Fair Student Funding and how to determine how the dollars follow the student. Now, it's true that each student receives a base level of funding, and students may also receive additional dollars based on special needs or other advanced academic factors. But one thing is that, you know, not all students cost the same to educate. So what is the current remedy to meet each student's educational needs based on Fair Student Funding?
Well, I think this is not quite the topic of the day, though. We're trying to talk about the kind of larger economic issues facing the state, the nation, and the world. And I think they're important. The question's important. I don't know if you want to...
Well, I mean, I was, you know, I'm a member of the school board, and, you know, our CEO that we brought from New York, Andres Alonso, is the one who introduced Fair Student Funding, the sort of per-pupil model. I'm not sure about the caller's numbers in terms of the per-pupil allocation. I believe the numbers are higher. But the point is that what happens is now money follows the student. So let's say my school is improving. My school is delivering higher quality education. In past years, that wouldn't mean anything to me as a principal in terms of my funding. But when my school is improving, what's going to happen? I'm going to attract more parents and their kids. My population of students grows. Underperforming schools, their population of students falls. They get less money. The better schools get more money. And so now all of a sudden I have an incentive to really ramp up my performance. This is a notion. Also, it's consistent with our CEO's view that more students should have more choice.
And we'll come back. We'll bring Aniban and perhaps the CEO on and some others to talk about all that, and we can raise local school issues very shortly, but not today. 410-319-8888. Brian, you're on the air.
Hi, good evening. I'm a first-time caller.
Great. Welcome.
Thank you. Well, my comment and question is...
We got to get him to say...
Brian, you there?
Yeah.
Go ahead.
My comment is that... I'm sorry, I'm hearing a voice.
Go ahead. Just hear what you got to say. I'm sorry.
Okay. Yeah. My comment and question is, since we no longer have the gold standard, you know, and I don't think that we should continue to, you know, you question capitalism. I don't think that we should continue to necessarily have the current economic, you know, models. But if we're going to do that, I think that we should consider, you know, infusing money into the economy by modern agricultural processes such as sky farming. So I'd like to know, you know, sky farming is the idea of using skyscrapers to produce you know, food for the world, so to speak. And I'd just like to know what the economists, you know, think about that idea.
Well, no, I have no problem with people growing food on the 54th floor of their Manhattan, you know, tower and so on and so forth. I'm skeptical that that would feed the world. It's a nice contribution. It certainly does improve air quality and so on and so forth. But I think that's part of a broader discussion of green infrastructure.
Right.
And which includes wind farms and solar power and so on and so forth, and modern agricultural techniques that use less water, so on and so forth. And I don't disagree with you one bit. And the better news about that is the president of the United States agrees with you, believes all about green technologies and biofuels and wind farms and solar energy. So there's going to be plenty of that to come.
And we will have many discussions on that in the coming year. Do we have time for another caller? We plumb out. I want to thank everybody for calling in today and making this show what it is. It's been a pleasure to hear all of you. This is a very important discussion. Aniban Bonbasu, you have helped stimulate the economic discussion on the airwaves. We really appreciate you being with us today. It's always a pleasure to see
Anytime,
you.
Anytime, Mark.
The Mark Steiner Show is made possible by Urbanite, Baltimore's free monthly magazine of ideas and innovation. This month's issues features breakthroughs. What's the next big thing and where will it come from? Urbanite's available at over 800 locations or at urbanitebaltimore.com. The Mark Steiner Show is produced by Justin Levy and Jessica Phillips. We're engineered today by Jamar Jones. Our interns are Christina Arison, and on the job today, Judith Lloyd. Our theme music is by Wal Matthews of Clean Cut. To hear this show again and podcast any of our past shows and hear additional interviews, visit us on the web at steinershow.org. And for Public Radio WEAA, 88.9 FM, the voice of the community, I'm Mark Steiner, and take care. The Mark Steiner Show is made possible by MECU, Baltimore's credit union, and the Maryland Department of Housing and Community Development.